You are listening to a Pleasure Podcast. For more from our sex podcast collective, visit pleasurepodcasts.com.
I'm Tristan Taramino, and this is Sex Out Loud.
That's why I'm literally writing a whole book about my gender.
My mom and I were on BBC together talking about sex work and disability, which is something I never thought I would ever do.
Where do we learn about how to react to bodily fluids?
People have abortions more than we want to admit, and abortion is beyond healthcare. It's really body autonomy.
Someone talks about porn ruining sex. The question for me is, which porn?
I don't want anybody to fetishize my Jewishness who wouldn't stand next to me at a march.
I just wanted to show polyamory in a way that looks like polyamory.
If you're excited by sexual pleasure and sexual politics, you've come to the right place.
I've been this radical queer agnostic theologian for a long time.
They think that Muslims don't have sex.
There is a very specific history of racism and anti-blackness in this country.
I don't know who started this myth that after people are sexually assaulted, they never want to fornicate again.
We really don't think that change happens without knowing what we're for and not just what we're against.
Welcome to Sex Out Loud, everyone. Hey, if you follow me on social media, I was surprised when I just posted a cover of a book for a guest I was going to have on my show. And it was one of the most viewed, liked, and shared posts on my Instagram in the past month. So I hope you've all showed up to now hear me talk about this book with its amazing author. Let me tell you who's here. Jen Mannion is Associate Professor of History at Amherst College. She is a social and cultural historian whose work examines the role of gender and sexuality in American life. Mannion is the author of Liberties, Prisoners, Carceral Culture in Early America, which received the inaugural Mary Kelly Best Book Prize from the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. Their most recent book, Female Husbands, A Trans History, that's the one I posted about, was supported by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities. Mannion has published dozens of essays from popular and scholarly audiences and serves on the editorial board of Amherst College Press, Early American Studies, and the William and Mary Quarterly. She's currently chair of the OAH Committee on the Status of LGBTQ Historians and Histories. Also, side note, she worked at a boatyard in P-Town for about 8 years, and she would radically defund the police and all prisons and carceral institutions. They love pizza, queer culture, and communities. So obviously, we have everything in common. Welcome to the show, Jen.
Thank you so much for having me.
There are so many strange overlaps between our lives because we're about the same age, and I also worked in P-Town for 2 summers when my dad lived there. There's a lot of weird coincidences. We're going to let them unfold as we talk today, okay?
Great.
So all I did was post a picture of the cover of your book. And, you know, I'm not saying people aren't readers, but usually that doesn't get like a whole lot of excitement on my Instagram feed. And yet like Twitter reminded me 18 times, this post is doing 98% better than any of your other posts. And I was like, okay, people are excited. So today we're going to talk about your book, Female Husbands, A Trans History. And I guess we should start by telling people how you define female husband.
Okay, well, I define female husband the way it was defined historically, and that is, it was used for most of its life to describe someone who was assigned female at birth, who at some point, usually in their teen years or their young adult years, transgender and lived as a man, and then entered into a legal marriage with a woman.
And so your book covers the 1700s and the 1800s, both in England and in the United States. It's literally one of the most riveting books I've ever read. And much to the dismay of my mentor, Claire Potter, I'm not that big of a history buff. Hi, Claire. Shout out to Claire Potter, an amazing historian. But this book, I literally could not put it down. And I was telling everyone while I was reading it, I was like giving them the blow by blow. So let's first talk about what were some of the reasons that people assigned female at birth began living their lives as men?
That's kind of like in some ways a million-dollar question because we never like really know.
Right.
Potentially what their core motivation was. And so the external factors are obvious that if you lived as a man in the 18th and 19th century, you could get a lot more pay for your work. You could enter into an intimate, sexual, potentially legal marriage relationship with a woman. And both of those things were denied to women or people assigned female who were living as women. Depending on where you were, you and how much wealth you had and what the laws were, it would vary dramatically. You might be able to vote, right? Which you couldn't if you were a woman. So the other explanation, which I think my book tries to offer, and that's why its subtitle is A Trans History, is that you could identify as male and in a way that is analogous to, you know, a contemporary transgender identity. So the records don't prove that for us, but I think it's always in the air as a certain possibility.
So let's talk about wealth, which you just brought up, because in your book, most of the female husbands that you wrote about were laborers, were working class, were the working poor. Only a few of them were kind of what we might consider now middle class. And sort of one of the things that signified their maleness and often why people didn't like question their maleness was because they were doing really heavy manual labor, even dangerous work, including some who became soldiers and went to war.
Right. I mean, I think that's one of the most interesting aspects of this whole story for me is that they were all laborers. They all came from usually pretty poor families, and people were left to fend for themselves. And in this case, again, the potential for economic stability, if you were a laboring man, was like much, much greater. In many cases, you would earn 4 to 5 times more for doing a similar work than if you were a woman. And as you just said, plus there's a whole other range of occupations that are open to you.
And what really interested me about, first of all, I felt like I saw you like over these like cracked pieces of paper studying this stuff. Like there was, I had these visions throughout the book where it was like you were in these archives and the paper was like crumbling in your hands. Because you went to a lot of primary source material. In addition to like marriage certificates, census records, court documents, I was fascinated to learn about the role that newspapers and books played in how female husbands were talked about, represented, how the ideas of the female husband were sort of disseminated to the mass market because newspapers were widely available, were cheap, were easy to get, were accessible. So how does a historian sort of piece together from newspapers when you yourself admit that in some cases, some newspapers would sort of take the kernel of truth of a story and then kind of embellish it?
Yeah, well, I think that is the story of this book, is the role of newspapers, because without the newspaper stories, you have, any people could have been living in obscurity as female husbands and queer wives and other people not necessarily knowing. But the fact that these stories broke through and became newsworthy and became headlines and, in some cases, a story, ran in one locale reporting on their neighbors, and then it would be reprinted and picked up hundreds, even thousands of miles away across the ocean to a whole other readership. So that I think it's easy to argue that everybody who read newspapers or had access to newspapers would have known about female husbands. And it's this part of our history that has been like not made available to us, to put it mildly. I think the other kind of sources that you mentioned, the dusty, moldy records that are really hard to work with and hard to find, they're important, the court records, the marriage licenses, the birth certificates, because they provide us with proof that these were real people who lived, and that they weren't just fabrications of an editor's imagination, even if, they might have pulled on a thread and made up a fanciful, detail in a sentence, that there's all of this evidence that these people really did live.
And the way that they got, the way that the stories were covered were that they were essentially sort of discovered. That's like the most neutral word I can think about, but, or outed in some way as men in the community who were suddenly found out to be assigned female at birth. And sometimes this happened at death when, they went to the morgue and someone examined their body. Sometimes this happened in the course of a divorce proceeding where their wives used this as a kind of a way to try to invalidate the marriage and get a divorce. Or sometimes they were injured. I mean, it always coincided with somehow the person intersecting with medicine or the law. Is there anyone else who was found out in some other way?
That's a very good question. So I'm sure, but I think the point is for us, like, why do these particular modes of outing then lend themselves to creating, investigations and then really formal like paper trails? So when it is a medical investigation or something involving the state, that's often how we learn about things. And one of the challenges with so much queer and trans history is we're denied access to like records about the other kinds of knowing and learning. So if you learn about someone, in another way and you write about it in your diary, that might be really hard to detect. Or we have all of this evidence of queer and trans people's records throughout history being destroyed, right? Or, not deemed worthy of preservation. So other kinds of knowing and informal communities and intimacies, which, we have every reason to believe female husbands and their queer wives would have been a part of, we just simply don't have records about.
Right. And also, I mean, it occurs to me too that there has to be a whole bunch of female husbands that were not discovered.
Of course.
Right. I mean, I know you're a historian, so you don't want to, you're very careful about speculation. That's very clear in the book, but I just wonder about like all the female husbands who were never discovered for a whole variety of reasons, or also if there were female husbands in other classes and because of their class status and their wealth, people either, no one sort of caused trouble for them. For lack of a better word.
Yeah, possibly, and yes, and we definitely know from queer history that wealth is like the number one signifier that gave people access to live a queer or homosexual life in some way less disturbed, right? Because wealth bought you a certain degree of like protection from authorities meddling in your business, and you might, if you didn't need to work, so all things like that. But the trend, I think, for people assigned female who identify as masculine or male and lean in that direction, we do have evidence of them not so much being female husbands, but just being maybe like an Ann Lister type. So somebody who kind of blends like male and female persona and clothing and affect, and, you know, certainly asserts many male privileges, but nobody questions their underlying sex. And they're not known as a man, they're known as a woman.
Right. So Ann Lister, for people who don't know, is a very famous, I like to think of her as the prototypical butch lesbian, a masculine woman who presented as a masculine woman and lived her life, but she was of a certain class. And so people sort of had to embrace her because of her wealth and standing in the community. And there's a great series based on her life called Gentleman Jack. If you haven't seen it, just press pause right now, go binge watch the whole thing, and then come back. That's how much I love that show.
What do you love about it?
Oh my God, Gentleman Jack. Okay, we have to take a commercial break. But when we come back, we'll stick to the subject and we'll talk about Gentleman Jack. Okay? Okay. Stay with us.
How do you keep your mind sharp? If trivia keeps you on your toes, then you need to play Trivia Star, the free mobile quiz app. It's a great way to test yourself. Choose from 60 different categories: music, sports, movies, animation, biology, TV, animals, celebrities, brands, sports, geography, even Disney. If you choose the correct answer from multiple choices and beat the clock, you move on to the next level. The questions get harder over time, but if you get stuck, don't worry. You can use coins and gems to get a hint and beat the level. Right now, Trivia Star is offering 2,500 coins and 500 gems when you download and play. Just go to Apple or Google Store and search for Trivia Star. Again, search Trivia Star and enjoy 2,500 coins and 500 gems. Download Trivia Star for free today. Trivia Star has 2,000 five-star reviews in the Apple Store. Join them and see if you're smart enough to win.
Welcome back to Sex Out Loud, everyone. I'm talking today with social and cultural historian and professor of history at Amherst College, Jen Mannion, who wrote one of my favorite books of 2020. It's called Female Husbands, A Trans History. Before the break, we got a little sidetracked into Gentleman Jack, which is a series, a television series based on the life of Ann Lister, who was a queer person slash lesbian slash butch lesbian slash genderqueer person. Like, we didn't have these words back then, but presented as a masculine woman and was generally accepted and lived that way for her entire life, and was involved with and had relationships with women openly. Jen wants to know why I love the show. Okay, so before we go on, I love Gentleman Jack. I mean, first of all, I feel like it's an amazing representation of queerness, like in a time when queerness wasn't a word or a concept. So for me, like, it's amazing to sort of see where we come from as queer people, right? Like, how this has been going on for centuries, and that I can relate to someone who is living an entirely different life in an entirely different place than I am. And just the acting and the writing is phenomenal. I mean, all the little sexy scenes are really great. Yeah, I'm all about it. And that lead character, you know, that the lead actress is really quite amazing. Why do you love Gentleman Jack?
No, for all the same reasons that you said. I think they capture like a female masculinity in a great way. That we are just like rarely get like representations of.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay, so let's talk about the book again, your book. So one of the things that was fascinating, like I said, there were these intersections with either medical institutions or legal institutions, which is some of the ways that we have records of this besides these media representations. But when people came into contact with the legal system, there's actually no law against cross-dressing or what you call transing gender. And for those who are married, they actually had these legal marriages, which were performed by priests or town officials or whoever like the person in charge performing marriages was. And so sometimes when a case was brought forward, either by a community member or by a wife wanting to divorce a female husband, they didn't even know what to charge them with.
Right. I mean, I think to me, that's one of the most fascinating threads that runs throughout the whole book, where some people think that something is wrong or not okay, like that the act of transing gender and, you know, entering into a legal marriage with a woman as a man is not something that person should be allowed to do, but they don't have like a clear argument for why. And there's nothing specific in most of the legal codes in most of these places to show that they were in violation of. And it's really, a lot of people get some kind of fuzzy, blurred charge for entering into a marriage under false pretenses. I think that happens in England in the 18th century. And then for most of the 19th century in the US, there's nothing, and people might get held as a vagrant for 30 to 60 days without trial, just detained. And that was really common. I mean, vagrancy laws were used quite expansively for all kinds of people who were deemed, you know, to be disorderly or a threat to the social order in some vague way. But it's really not until after the Civil War that we start to see more and more municipalities and cities passing explicit anti-cross-dressing ordinances that could then later be used as the basis for a charge or a punishment against someone.
Because the thing about marriage is you really make the case that marriage is one of the best ways to legitimize a person's gender. In other words, if there's like a guy rolling around and you're like suspicious of him in some way, if he's married, your suspicions sort of die out because you're like, no, that's a dude, because dudes are married and dudes have wives and look, he has a wife. And I really appreciated that you recognized and acknowledged that the stories of the wives of female husbands aren't readily available to us. There is no, the newspaper often didn't ask the wife of the female husband or didn't interview them. Or on the other hand, often we can't necessarily trust what was said on the public record because it's difficult to know. I mean, if there was a legal case, it's difficult to know if the wives of female husbands denounced them or said they didn't know and they were duped. And did they do that in order to save their own reputation or their own standing in the community and the reputation of their families? I mean, we don't have like a first person account from one of these wives.
Yeah, I mean, I think the wives are still the most interesting and perplexing subjects in the book that I hope somebody else or maybe myself does more work on, really trying to like uplift and unpack their, you know, histories and perspectives. Because as you said, there's so many reasons why we don't get access to them. Everyone at the time when these people were living, and even historians looking back, like the person who crossed gender or transgender, like they're instantly seen as like, you know, the bold, you know, rebel rousing troublemaker who, you know, obviously like challenged the gender binary. But I do think an argument could be made that it's the queer wives who are actually the real threat, potentially, because for so many different reasons. One, that they could potentially, first of all, just be undetected, that nobody upon meeting them or upon learning about their histories might think of them as queer or, you know, challenging heteronormativity or challenging the gender binary, because they are people who could have a consciousness around their own sexual desire and sexual pleasure that is not necessarily visible, right, to the people trying to make sense of these records. And late in the 19th century, we do start to get conversation about concern, we have to kind of stop this, because what if women realize that they can be in happy relationships with people who are assigned female living as men, and then they realize that they don't need cisgender men for happiness or marriage. And that would be like a really big problem for heteronormativity and basically the whole social structure.
Yeah, I just I hope someone digs into that, because I do feel like there must be someone somewhere who can find something about these wives who, I think, like you said, were also rebellious, but they weren't necessarily seen as that. And then how they had to represent themselves to the community was really under pressure to whatever the situation was happening, you know. So I think we don't even get a clear picture of what they sort of said at the court hearing or said after the person's death. We can't necessarily trust that as 100% their inner truth.
No,
because there was a lot at stake.
There's so much at stake, and the process that makes female husbands visible and exciting really suppresses and contains female wives. It has the opposite effect on them, because they're women in a patriarchal society. I mean, it's just the constraint that goes into effect to try to deny that they knew anything about their husband's sex or gender, to deny that they were possibly experiencing sexual pleasure in these relationships. And as you said, in so many cases, they don't even record their names or their full legal names. Like, they just completely get erased. Which is a common thing that happens to poor women in the historical record. And it's just shame.
So when female husbands were sort of found out or outed, there were various things that the legal system sort of tried to do. But one thing that stood out to me was, you know, in this case, like gender, specifically transing your gender, if you were assigned female, meant a kind of freedom for people, freedom to like move freely about the world as a man, freedom to do these jobs that they wanted to do, freedom to own property, and like sit on town councils, you know, because some of these female husbands were like these majorly upstanding citizens. So right. That even when they found out, like, the community was a little bit like, wait, what? But we like that guy so much. And he's like such a model guy. Wow, that's confusing. I mean, just seeing different communities like try to sort of make sense of it was really interesting. But you also wrote that in some cases, when they intersected with the legal system, gender was the punishment. Talk a little bit about that.
Right. So this was in so many cases, and this is especially true in a lot of the other records of quote unquote female sailors and female soldiers. There's hundreds, if not thousands of them, where when someone is found out to have been assigned female at birth and living as a man, the first punishment is to ungender them, basically to try to force them at the very least to change their clothing. And they're often ushered, you know, a set of women's clothes and, you know, demanded to change into them. And then with the hope or the order that they also assume a more typically female deportment and affect as they resume life.
And some of them went on to then live their lives as women, but others like moved away to another town and kind of started over, but still lived their lives as masculine beings and men and identified as men. But the clothes, that's another really fascinating part of this, is like the really heteronormative sort of clothing of the time. I mean, it's like one of the first ways that you identified who was a man and who was a woman was by what they were wearing, which today seems like a little bit bananas, because like anyone can wear pants. But back then, it was so strictly gendered that some of the first steps that people took to trans their gender was to simply put on clothes that were, quote, men's clothes.
Yeah, I mean, that could be it. I mean, that was exactly as you said, because clothing was so gendered and such a strict binary. I mean, it was also, you know, shaped by class too. But absolutely. And I think the other interesting thing related to that is, until the end of the 19th century, most people thought that gender was as simple as that, that it was about your clothing, and that by changing back your clothing, you would change back someone's gender. They didn't think if they met you and you were someone who had transgender and was living as a man, that that said anything more about you, like that you had some kind of interior sense of your own gender identity as male, and that therefore you would not be able or willing to simply change your clothes and then change your gender. That concept didn't really exist yet. And so the upside of that is the punishments could be through when you see what happens to Joseph Lobdell, you know, down the line, the punishments were actually kind of soft, right? 60 days in jail and put on women's clothing, as opposed to what happens to people later in the 19th century and the early 20th century, when we do start to gain an understanding of gender identity as something more fixed and more interior and less easily, you know, manipulate it simply by clothing.
Okay. And you've given me a perfect segue into my next section here, but we're going to take a commercial break. And we are going to talk about how female husbands and other folks who transgendered way back when then forced other people to reckon with notions about gender. And they weren't necessarily ready to do that. But we'll talk more about that with Jen Mannion when we get back. When I want to feel more centered and grounded, I grab my phone, open the Calm app, and do a 5-minute meditation. Some of their latest daily guided meditation topics have been the art of letting go, finding peace within chaos, using sound for mindfulness, or how to prioritize what's truly important. Maybe you haven't meditated before. No worries. There's a great program on how to meditate. And there's also plenty more. Music, sleep stories, breathing exercises, even stuff for kids. I've been having trouble getting a good night's sleep, and the Calm sleep stories really help. Calm has a lot of tools to make you feel better, and who doesn't want that? For listeners of the show, Calm is offering a special limited time promotion of 40% off a Calm premium subscription at calm.com/Tristan. That's hundreds of hours of programming. Calm's entire library and new content is added every week. Get started today at calm.com/Tristan for 40% off a premium subscription. That's calm.com/Tristan. Over 85 million people around the world use Calm to take care of their minds and get better sleep. Welcome back to Sex Out Loud. Hey, we're talking today about this book, Female Husbands, A Trans History, written by Jen Mannion, who's an associate professor of history at Amherst College and a lifelong LGBTQIA plus activist. So Jen, you brought this up before the break, and it was kind of where I was going next, which is that one of the things that female husbands and the sort of revelation that they existed did was that it sort of forced communities and the media and the law to try to make sense of people assigned female at birth who lived their lives as men. And in the beginning, it seemed like there was a sense of fluidity. Like sometimes in articles, they would use both pronouns. They would use he and she. They would kind of go back and forth. And then there seemed to be, like you said, a more rigid gender binary. But still, I'm paraphrasing here, but I remember one person said about a female husband, there's something like their spirit and soul were masculine, but their sex was female. And that just struck me as like, that was hundreds and hundreds of years ago. And there are some mask people, there are some trans people today who might describe themselves that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think that quote was in reference to Robert Gray, one of the soldiers in chapter 3. That was a really unusual quote. And there was actually another one. I think somebody later down the line in the 1850s referenced James Howe in that way. So yeah, I think the idea of some kind of interior gender identity is there in a small, small way in reference to a couple of people. And it feels very modern. And there, you know, I think we might want to consider that, you know, sexologists at the turn of the century got that idea from some of these accounts. As you know, regular people, writers, editors, tried to make sense of soldiers and husbands in the press. So definitely.
Well, yeah. And also there were some descriptions sometimes where they said like, oh, you know, they were often used the they pronouns for all the people in the book. So like they were a sort of masculine child, or they did masculine activities as a child. Like, so there are some clear parallels with what we think of as modern trans identity, even back then.
Definitely. I mean, I think the distinction is when whether they're referencing activities, like, you know, they did things that boys like to do, which is super common. And you can find that in lots of places about lots of people assigned female. But the standout lines are when they reference it as being their, like, inside their spirit, right? Or their soul, that person like had the soul of a man. That's, you know, when it speaks to me as something that became incorporated in sexology at the turn of the century to try to make sense of homosexuality. And then the extent to which that language has been the foundation of, you know, transgender, you know, life and politics for much of the 20th century and into the 21st century since then.
And also, it feels like in the work that you did, you also revealed just how early on people began conflating sex with gender and with sexual orientation. In other words, there was this notion that maybe the female husband, like first, there people were just talking about these female husbands, they married women. But then as we progressed, it was like, wait, they married women, this is a same-sex marriage, they're lesbians. So masculinity in female assigned people equals lesbians, which again, we didn't say lesbians back then. But it's like those two things got conflated and squished together. And those things still haven't been really teased apart fully. People still conflate those to this day.
You know, that question of when and why they got smushed together, that female masculinity or masculine affects in someone assigned female at birth equaled homosexuality, like when did that become the case? Because that was like literally my first question for this project, because well, we know it becomes the case in the late 19th, early 20th century, because sexologists become obsessed with it and that's all they write about. And they form some of the foundational ideas of homosexuality, which is that you're a sexual invert. So that the prototypical female homosexual is a masculine person. But that was not the case for most of the 18th and 19th century. And I think that for me, for queer people interested in this, and for me as a historian of sexuality, like that's one of the big takeaways. Like, oh, so for most of history, when someone encountered a female husband and their queer wife, they saw them through the lens of gender. They really did see them as a trans figure. Mm-hmm. People weren't even remotely in the ballpark of thinking about homosexuality. That gets created later. That's a really early 20th century invention. And we've been stuck with it
ever since.
Yeah.
And this makes me think of who is the female husband who ran like a tavern with his wife and was just really like beloved by their community?
James Howe.
Yeah, James Howe. Okay. So this reminds me of that because I feel like there, in many ways, there were like less harsh reactions because James Howe, to completely oversimplify it, was a really good guy.
Yeah, he was a model patriarch, right?
And so the idea that they like didn't even investigate sort of, wait, did they have a sexual relationship? Wait, what about his wife? What's his wife's desire? What's his desire? They just were like, God, he was such a good guy. I mean, I just, this is weird. Like they couldn't really denounce it altogether.
Yeah, I think that is a really powerful story that kind of blows my mind.
I mean, and it gives us a little bit of hope also that not all of these folks were sort of shunned and banished from their communities. Because they also, some of them were, and it was really sad and really unfortunate. And the level of discrimination that they faced as soon as they were sort of found out could be really painful and intense.
Agree. And I think one of the other takeaways is that the medical field has actually been really a really destructive force for trans and non-binary people throughout history, because it's really with the professionalization and expansion of medicine and their obsession with trying to categorize us and label us that we have experienced, you know, tremendous amount of suffering and oppression. And, you know, I think that's why a lot of trans, and especially trans, but also queer people today, you know, are, you know, cautious and I think skeptical about some of the ways that some doctors, you know, get to serve as gatekeepers.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that started all the way back then, which was if someone wanted to know, they called the doctor. Exactly. The doctor was the final say. The doctor was, you know, above reproach or critique. And that was the person who ultimately defined someone's sex was the doctor. And so you can see the early roots of this and the early roots of what's going to become this really intense abuse of, for example, intersex folks when they're born, as children, as adults. The doctor sort of steps forward as the authority on sex, who then becomes the authority on gender.
Right. I'm laughing just because you jump from sex to gender, and I think both those things happen. Yeah, it's the scope of their authority becomes pretty wide ranging, and usually very destructive for queer, trans, and intersex people for most of our history.
So towards the end of the book, I got a sense, and you sort of put into context, that this history that you've done sort of shakes up GLBTQIA plus history a little bit. Or what we've known about it thus far, or how we've treated certain subjects. Can you talk a little bit more about that? I mean, I felt like you were like holding back, you're being a little humble. You're like, no, but maybe this is different than what some other people have said. But like, it seems like you're crashing a party here of some things, of some things we thought we knew and were pretty like settled on.
Maybe
you're going to be now with me about that.
Maybe we're just throwing a new party.
Okay. Great. Let's reframe. New party.
No, I think that the predominantly lesbian gay people who started the field of the history of sexuality were interested in understanding sexual orientation.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore often sublimated gender in their analysis because they were really trying to understand sexual orientation. And I think that, you know, I am just one person, actually, another wonderful trans scholar
Jules Gill Peterson, who wrote a book about, you know, the history of transgender child, I think also shows this in their work about the turn of the century, how much the story is really about gender, how much sexologists are obsessed with gender nonconformity and gender deviance. And in the field of the history of sexuality, that all gets read in relation to sexual desire and sexual orientation. And I think what some of us are now saying is, let's actually, you know, go back and see what the story around gender is. And in many ways, that moment and that turn has been really, really destructive for trans people, not just trans histories, but trans lives and the ways that trans experiences, non-binary, gender nonconforming people have in some ways really been marginalized and suffering for the last 100 years in the LGBTQ community because of that framing.
Because the lens, which is informed by sexologists from way long ago who aren't right, like sort of still exists, right? I mean, that's the other thing is that I feel like what exists in this space of like of female husbands is some of them could have been queer and their only option to have an intimate committed relationship with a woman was to present as masculine or male. But then there were just trans people. And I feel like that, again, that it seems like the female husband becomes this space where you can really see all the different nuances instead of just saying, oh, wait, that person dressed in men's clothing, they were a lesbian.
Right. I mean, I think, and also just if I, to give credit to the trans community and the trans, you know, political rights movement and other studies in other scholars in trans studies, who've really, you know, given us the language for just reimagining and expanding how we understand gender and how we talk about it. I mean, so that my book was written through that lens. And I think that's part of what makes it like expansive and open new possibilities for centering gender in the histories of these people's lives in a way that, you know, was not possible before, because even, you know, lesbian and gay historians still privileged assigned sex at birth and legal names from birth and wrote about these people in a way that, you know, to our contemporary sensibilities is just incredibly transphobic and inaccurate. And so all of this is only even possible because of the work of trans activists and community building and thinking for the last 30 years.
That's a really great point. That's a really great point. Well, I love this book. I recommend it to everyone. I especially recommend it to people who feel differently gendered. And I'm not even going to define that in any other way. But for me, to think about people, and in this case, because I'm descended from very white waspy people, so these are like really my people, to think about people really having complex genders and that this has been going on since the beginning of time and this is not new and no one invented this, and regardless of what the TERFs or the SWERFs say, I don't know, there was some comfort there too. So thank you for writing this book. Thank you for doing all this really intense history.
Thank you for all of your tremendous body of work and for having me on.
The book is called Female Husbands, A Trans History from Cambridge University Press. You can get it wherever you buy books. I especially encourage you to support local and independent bookstores, which you can do through bookshop.org. You can find Jen on Twitter at @activisthistory. I want to thank my engineer and editor, A-Rod, for doing the show. He's from FTC Designs, and you can follow him on Twitter at @FTC_designs. New episodes go up on podcast platforms on Mondays. In the meantime, you can find me across all social media at Tristan Terramino. And please, 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 if you haven't already,
vote.